Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. We have a very special presentation for you today. We have certainly talked a fair amount of the pro graps in our time previously on the program, and we have with us one of the biggest names of the last quarter century in the business, a man who had an outstanding resume. If you just look at his qualifications, wrestling is a very nebulous kind of industry on what's considered Hall of Fame qualifications. You have ability to draw, ability to work, a lot of different ways. But if you just look at the amalgam of it, the charisma projected, I think, again, very little doubt that this man is a Hall of Fame talent and somebody who was a two-time former world heavyweight champion and somebody who beat two greats of the game. As such as it is, it does matter who you go over, I think, to a certain extent if we're looking at the quality of the wins. Barry Windham and, of course, Hulk Hogan, maybe the biggest name in the history of the business. He became world champion from both of those men in 1991 and 1997, respectively. But again, making a very, very substantive turn in his life towards God and embracing religion, and that is the subject of his book, Wrestling with the Devil, The True Story of a World Champion Professional Wrestler, His Reign, Ruin, and Redemption. So we're going to be talking about that today on the program with Lex Luger. It is going to be very, very exciting to speak with this gentleman. Again, somebody who, if you've watched the business, if you kind of grew up watching it as I did and followed it and into the late 90s boom period when it really got great again, this is a guy who is synonymous with, I think, some of the best memories and some of the best times in the business, somebody who worked for both of the major national promotions of the last 25 years, that being WCW and the WWF, of course, WWF as it was known at that point in time. Also subsequently worked just briefly with Impact Wrestling, TNA, which is in many ways sort of the spiritual descendant of the ruins of WCW, I guess you could say. But it's hard to count TNA really as a big two promotion, regardless of having a major national television contract. That's one of those things where Rob Van Dam, Ric Flair, others, I think, have said that they would get stopped in airports and asked by people, why are you no longer in wrestling, when they would be appearing on national television every week on the TNA program. So I think Lex's time there really just kind of a footnote to an excellent career. It was this is a man from whom great things were expected in the world of professional wrestling, and I think in the end great things were delivered. Many, many memorable moments in his career, and that is really kind of the currency of professional wrestling. Memorable moments, being in situations and programs that had an ability to draw money. And this is a man where I think it could be said maybe wasn't always put to the best use by the folks in the booking office. Somebody who had a tremendous career, and perhaps maybe even more could have been done in certain situations, but nevertheless, his ability, his work rate, his just everything that he brought to the table really helped him to get over and to stay over for extended periods of time. And really, I think you'll find also as well, and this is this says a lot about a wrestler as well, the times when he was less over were also kind of the times when really nobody was. I mean, you could point to sort of the dying days of WCW, and he was about as over as anybody was at that point in time. The place had been killed. There was pretty much salt that had been thrown on the ashes. And again, he was about as over as anybody was at that point, and just kept showing up and working through what had to be a sort of professional malaise, as badly as things were going there. And yet he was doing so through what he now reveals to be the ruins of his personal life. The late 90s were really when things kind of started building, and then subsequently you make it into the new millennium, and his situation, the relationship that he had with Elizabeth Hewlett, known to one and all as the lovely Miss Elizabeth, that was kind of out in the open at that point. And then her shocking and tragic demise. She was battling through drug issues, as Lex was. And the fact that it happened to her final chapter, as it were, was basically written at his home, that caused him a great degree of legal difficulty, at least at the moment, certainly a great amount of embarrassment personally and professionally, and really just a tough situation. So there were really, really brutal things that were building up to Lex's subsequent embrace of religion and subsequent awakening and realization of everything that God had to offer him. And just as he was in the process of trying to come to grips with his newfound faith and awareness, he ended up suffering paralysis over a period of time and had to work to regain just the ability to walk and to get around. And when you read his really excellent book, it was a big deal just for him to be able to drive himself once again. And prior to that, perform even certain basic body functions again, unaided by anyone else. And this is a man that, again, if you were a kid like me, you know, you grew up watching this guy slap people in the torture rack on TV and just display his unbelievable strength. A man who, for a brief period of time, competed also as a bodybuilder in the WBF. That was when he first went to the WWF, and he was under the no-compete clause and couldn't work for Vince McMahon as a wrestler for the first year or so, so he ended up in the WBF. So not just a really strong and really muscular professional wrestler. That's one thing, but a guy who was at a legitimate bodybuilding level for a good part of his professional career, and what he was reduced to subsequently with the paralysis and everything that he had to fight through, and really just being it would almost be understating it to say a shell of himself physically, because you would think when you say a shell of himself physically, okay, well, this was one of the most muscular pro wrestlers of all time, and okay, maybe we're thinking here middle age, he's getting a little soft, whatever, maybe a little bit less defined. No, not that kind of shell of a man. Shell of a man as in couldn't even really get around at all, had to battle back from paralysis. That is just remarkable. And for anybody who's known folks who have any kind of spinal conditions like that of a really, really severe nature, that's just so much to try to battle through. And again, it was his faith and his fortitude that sustained him, and that ultimately is the reason that his book is named the way that it is, Wrestling with the Devil, the True Story of a World Champion Professional Wrestler, His Reign, Ruin, and Redemption. An excellent book. I would greatly like to thank his publisher for sending us a copy of the book to be able to review prior to our discussion with him. This is Tyndale Momentum, an imprint of Tyndale House Publishers Incorporated. So greatly want to thank those folks for getting us ready for this discussion with Lex Luger. Hoping to get him on the phone lines here momentarily. We are awaiting a call in from him. But again, yeah, a man who had really an epic career in professional wrestling, somebody who had been briefly a college football player, transferred from Penn State to the University of Miami, didn't last very long at Miami either, just found out that he wasn't really cut out temperamentally for the college game, subsequently went on to the CFL, later on in the 80s, the UFL, or USFL rather, happens to bump into longtime pro wrestler and trainer Bob Roop at a celebrity golf outing in Florida, and the rest is history. Trains with the legendary Hiro Matsuda in 1985 and 1986, the same Hiro Matsuda who trained Hulk Hogan, a man to whom Lex would be compared many times over the course of his career, not just in 1993 when he was picking up the All-American gimmick and going with that. But again, Hiro Matsuda trains him. He bursts onto the scene in 1986 in Florida, just a huge sensation. They put the Southern Heavyweight Championship on him very quickly, spent a great year down in Florida, worked with Ric Flair a couple of different times, subsequently gets the call up to Jim Crockett Promotions, and the rest is history. Everything really took off from there. But I see that we now have Lex Luger on the phone line. So just to set things up again here, everyone, would like to welcome everyone who is tuning in for us today. FDH Lounge, mini episode number 300. We were hoping to get a truly epic guest for this occasion, and I feel that we certainly do. This man is a two-time former WCW World Champion, held many other titles, including the World Tag Team titles and the United States Heavyweight title. We've had a number of his former co-workers on the show, J.J. Dillon, Tully Blanchard, Jim Cornette, Joe Laurinaitis, Missy Hyatt, among others, Bret the Hitman Hart. So I'm sure some of those names are bound to come up in the course of our discussion. We also have the obligatory Crockett Promotions question that we like to ask anybody who was there back then. It's sort of an ongoing joke on the show, my need to keep asking this question, but I always get the same answer from everybody, and my guess is it will be the same answer from this gentleman as well. Right about now, 20 years ago, I'd say almost to the moment, this guy was probably in a bus somewhere. The legendary Lex Express, preparing for what was to be the biggest match of his career, arguably. You can look through his career, and that's kind of debatable whether or not it was, but he was certainly the focus of the promotion in 1993 in the WWF. He went on to SummerSlam to defeat Yokozuna for the title. It was by countout, so the WWF title did not accrue to him after that. But, yeah, right about now, 20 years ago, probably on a bus somewhere, making that that trip all throughout the country that we all remember so well. And it's a pleasure to have him here on the FDH Lounge, the show where nothing is off topic. We're a big fan of his professional career, but I'd say right about now, even a bigger fan of him personally, because of this great book that he wrote and the way that he's really turned his life around. The book is Wrestling with the Devil, the true story of a world champion professional wrestler, his reign, ruin, and redemption. I, Rick Morris, very honored to bring on the show the one and only Lex Luger, known variously as the Total Package and at one time the Narcissist. Lex Luger, pleasure to have you on the program, sir. Thank you for joining us today.
Wow, Rick. Great intro, my friend. Thank you for all those kind words. You are up to speed on everything. Thank you. It's great to be on.
Oh, thanks, Lex. I always try to put people over strong at the outset, you know, for particularly somebody like you. Man, I watched you on TV so much of my life, I got to tell you, and it's just, I have to say also, too, one of the things that really kind of left me kind of bemused from your book, and I noticed this from some shoot interviews previously, is when you came into the business, I don't think you even knew how big of a deal you were, like, say, in the After magazines and everything. To a kid like me flipping through these things, who is this Lex Luger guy down in Florida? You know, I went on vacation with my family in 86. We were down in Florida. I was like, I want to see wrestling, and I didn't get around to it on the trip. I think we weren't around at the right time. But it seems like all of this was sort of beyond you. You just had this narrow kind of focus. You didn't even really know, from what you've said, much about the difference between the WWF and the NWA.
That's a nice way to put it. Ignorance, you said, you termed it narrow focus. I love it. You're so nice. Yeah, I was all football and very focused on that. And we, us football players, always loved, for the most part, all of us, I loved watching wrestling. We thought it was fun to watch, but and I'd heard about WrestleMania and Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant, and that, you know, piqued my interest about how big wrestling was. But, yeah, I didn't grow up watching it, really, and I wasn't an avid follower of it. So, yeah, I had no idea how I got swept up into all that. It's an incredible story.
It really is. And I got to tell you, too, and you might be hearing this for the first time, but one of the things that the Aftermags had back then, I know you said in the book, you clarified you're from Buffalo, you're not from Chicago, but of course you were billed professionally as being from Chicago. One of the things that the Aftermags had about you, there was a story about the motivation of Lex Luger, that he learned how to channel hate and brutality as a small kid. Allegedly, you were witness at the 1968 Democratic National Convention to hippies getting their heads bashed in by the police, and that you learned at that moment the power of hate and how to channel it. So there were things being written about your character, I'm sure, that you were even beyond you at that point in time.
I'm sure that's way over my head.
I just always thought that was funny, in particular when I found out you weren't from Chicago.
That's good.
You got to give those guys credit. They were pretty creative.
Oh my goodness, they're the best. The wrestling brain trust can see most creative people on the planet Earth for sure.
They truly are. There's no question about
that.
Well,
they made a so-called wrestling star. Man, that takes a lot of talent.
It really, the ability of people to be creative and to kind of fill in the blanks on stuff and to tell stories is just really outstanding. But it's funny, you know, you mentioned the football, and it does seem like taken together, the football, the wrestling, everything like that, that it seems like from your description of it in the book that I guess obviously your family was very much into education. I knew that. I knew how seriously they took that. But it seems like from what you were saying in the book, that your father was, I guess you could say, sort of bemused at best that his son had grown up to be this athletic marvel.
Once again, nice way of putting it, Rick. He thought I was out of my mind. Man. And then when I got out of football, which I thought was crazy enough, I jumped into wrestling. Then they really thought I'd lost it. My goodness. Insane. They thought I just totally lost my mind.
When you were on top of the world, say like when you were a world heavyweight champion on either of the occasions, and the second one obviously being pretty brief, but the first one lasted for a good long period of time there, you know, 6 months, 8 months, whatever it was. What was the thought then? Would you be coming back home as world heavyweight champion?
Be with my family?
Yes, yes. What were their thoughts then? Like, look at how big I made it, Dad.
Oh, yeah, I used to try rubbing it once in a while. They were cool with it. They were supportive. You know, my mom started collecting the wrestling magazines that I couldn't imagine. My mom at the grocery store hanging out the aisle looking over the wrestling magazines. So I thought that was hilarious based on, as you know, they're all about music and education. I kind of pictured my mom. I wish I had we had those camera phones back then. Someone could get a picture of my mom at the grocery store aisle looking over the wrestling magazines. That would have been a big crack up.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure her friends probably would have been a little bit surprised, particularly if they didn't know the whole story. But you know,
I got great
going
family.
Through.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, they sound excellent, Lex. It sounds very enviable. You know, to have parents that love you and really want the best for you and everything. It does sound like a great situation.
It was. They didn't understand it, but they still were supportive and loving.
Ultimately, yeah, that's all you can ask for is, you know, that they try to get behind something, whether or not they fully understand it. I know in the course of tracing through your life, and particularly as we get a little bit later on, we're going to get to some of these issues of changing perspective, your religious awakening that you've had in recent years. But I'm just curious, because as you're looking back on things and you're seeing things in a different light, most of it has to do, I would guess, from your perspective and how you're seeing it. But there's one instance in particular that wouldn't have so much to do with your perspective, and that being you had basically what amounted, I guess, to more or less a cup of coffee at Penn State. But you were there long enough to get a feel for the place, the culture of it. And I'm sure you, like the rest of the world, were shocked by what would come out in 2011 about some of the things that had happened there. So is that something that subsequently, looking back on it, where you've seen anything in a different light as far as the culture of the place and how much everybody worshiped football? Were there some things that just you started to look at a little bit differently?
It's when I was there, I mean, no one would have, of course, had an inkling of what was going on with Sandusky, of course. He was our defensive coordinator at the time, and he was a very popular coach, very enthusiastic. The guys really, really loved playing for him, so no one could have had an inkling of the monster that lurked beneath the scenes there. As far as the culture there, oh, yeah, I mean, football, like so many universities around the country, is just worshipped. So there was that culture where you could see that if something went wrong and it was in a small college town, they'd have big press scrutiny. If, and I'm not saying this is exactly what happened, you could see that if something did go wrong behind the scenes, they might either want to or try to sort of keep it from not breaking out in the full court with the big media press that would maybe besmirch the university or the football program. So there was that culture there for sure. I think that's possible. Any program, obviously, they want to protect the program if they can.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
That, it's unfathomable that would be even a consideration. But there definitely is that whole culture, not just at Penn State, but a lot of the big schools where if something does go wrong, we've seen it in other things. Nothing is heinous as child molestation, but they do try to cover things up sometimes.
Sure,
for sure.
That's the nature of the beast, and yes, unfortunately for the victims who were not able to get justice from everything that happened there, yeah, it did stay buttoned up for such a period of time. But you mentioned, of course, where Jerry Sandusky is now, and that sort of this might be a interesting segue point here, but your old colleague Tully Blanchard and the Four Horsemen has done a lot of prison ministry. I'm just curious, in the course of your Christian outreach work, has any of that overlapped with Tully? Have you come into contact with him at any of the events you've been at?
No, we haven't yet. I'm looking forward to it, though. I heard Tully has been doing a lot of good stuff with that in the last few years, recent years. I'm really happy for him. I'm glad he's doing that.
I was very impressed when I got to talk to him on the program.
I've never met the new Tully. I only knew the old Tully, and I didn't like him much.
Well, that's interesting.
He was almost arrogant as he back then.
One conversation with the man, so I wouldn't profess to know, but I would guess that you would like the new Tully. He was a very very nice guy, spoke very eloquently about his career and all the good changes that he's had similar to you. And in looking at that, I know that when you joined the Four Horsemen in 87, when you got the call up to Crockett, I know that, you know, Tully, obviously, and Arn Anderson were instrumental in helping to develop and advance your career and teach you some things and really sort of help you to get to the process of becoming the man in a big promotion. I'm curious in particular, because in the last decade, Arn Anderson has been very, very instrumental with the guy who's probably been the biggest star of the last decade, John Cena. I know that he's done a lot of behind-the-scenes work with him, and probably in a lot of ways, I would guess, similar to what he did with you. So what does a mind like Arn Anderson have to teach to somebody like a Lex Luger or a John Cena to help make them better?
I think it's a special talent that they possess. Not only were the other horsemen, I mean, what an incredible learning environment to be in and be mentored by in wrestling. Ric Flair, J.J. Dillon, Arn Anderson, Tully Blanchard, all of them not only had a special talent in wrestling as technicians and tacticians in the ring, but they also had a spirit of discipleship. They were also, not only were they big stars and top performers, but the unusual aspect of them, they were also, I don't think this gets talked about, star makers. They took their stardom and their abilities and made stars of other. I can't even express, from Hiro Matsuda, who helped break me in, he went ringside me as a manager. Looking back on it now, like you said, I might not have truly understood or appreciated it at the time, but look back now and see the guys that were in my life back then who poured into me and told me to take me to a ring and work with me in the ring one-on-one, because I was just so rough around the edges. And just to see the time and effort they put in is what an incredible opportunity to be around them so early in my career. Just fabulous. All of them were just great.
Well, somebody that you might have had a chance to work against in the first year, I don't remember any specific matches coming to mind, but this is the thing I had alluded to before. So sort of the obligatory question for anybody that worked for Crockett at the time. So I have to tell you, when I was a kid, the guy who was just about my favorite was Ronnie Garvin. So I was thrilled to death when he became world champion that year. And unfortunately, there's been a real spirit of what I would call revisionism creeping into the wrestling industry. And, oh, how did this guy ever get to be world champion and everything? And again, his title reign was not booked well, but he seems to take a lot of, I would say, unfair shots from people who don't really understand the place that he, the role that he played in the promotion at the time. What were your thoughts about Ronnie Garvin working with him and what he had to offer a promotion?
I didn't work with him a lot, but I know Ric Flair thought highly of him, and I valued Ric Flair's opinion of people, and he just had a certain credibility with the fans. I always thought the fans truly picked the stars, and at that time, that promotion, Ric Flair had a great eye for it. The fans bought into Ronnie Garvin. He truly was a real life, a tough guy kind of guy, and he had a certain swagger because of that, and it carried over into the ring, and the fans definitely bought into Ronnie Garvin for sure. I love that stomp thing he did. I used to love that. He stomped around the whole guy. Oh, man. I love that.
That was awesome.
I didn't dare do it because I was afraid he might punch me out in the back, but I never tried to steal it, but that was great.
Well,
Ronnie Garvin,
you know,
stomp around.
Oh, he was awesome. That's a memorable thing. People remember that to this day. It was a part of his repertoire. Again, yeah, I mean, what you said, it's funny. I mean, there are elements of what you said right there that were the same as what J.J. Dillon said when he was on the show, what Tully said. And I think Tully also said, hey, I had to work a series, I think this was in 86, of taped fist matches against the guy around the horn. Somebody want to tell me the guy wasn't the real deal?
Well, if anybody could do it, it's Tully. He can bring out the best in anybody. He was fabulous at that.
Oh, he truly was. And, you know, just all of those guys back then in that promotion. And again, you know, in looking back on that, you know, with the career and, you know, subsequently, you go on to become the United States champion there, World Tag Team Champions, subsequently again in 91, World Heavyweight Champion for the first time. This is one of these things in looking at this, again, as I said earlier, I think it's very nebulous with pro wrestling on what constitutes a Hall of Fame career because there's different criteria, but I would think objectively by most measures, certainly your career would qualify for as big as you were, for as long as you were an important name in this business. This is one of these things that's interesting. At the outset of the 90s, there was a lot of talk about, oh, Sting, Luger, going to be the wrestlers of the 90s. I think maybe we didn't know how long Hogan and Flair were going to be all around. That would have been a surprise to anybody in 1990.
They're still around.
Yeah. I think we expected them to fade from the scene, you guys to take the torch, and it would be a little more linear. Pro wrestling isn't that linear, I guess, you know, but it's funny. You look at that, though, but you also look at some of the other things that came into play with your career. As big as you were, you had some issues where I think most people would say the booking was probably not the best. You would flip from quote-unquote good to quote-unquote bad, you know, fairly often. There was the thing about can't win the big one with the matches with Flair in 88. That kind of trickled over to the finish for the Yokozuna match in 93. So I know right now, obviously your perspective on things is so great. Everybody that reads the book knows that you're not a guy that would have been eaten up by bitterness at this stage of your life. Prior to your awakening, did you ever look at that and say, because you were never once a guy, it seems like it was involved in the politics of the business, but did you ever look at it prior to that and say, hey, man, I was pretty big, but had it not been for outside things, I could have been even bigger?
No, you know, putting myself back into the mode I was back then, I was so confident, some people would say arrogant, about my look and my place in the business. I thought, if they want to put a belt on me, that's their loss if they don't. And I was pretty much of the mentality that I want to be the best high productivity, low maintenance guy. Man, she would taught me, be a good foot soldier. Don't be a behind the scenes political guy with the booking. He said, just do what they tell you to do. The best of your abilities, your body is your costume. Make sure you always maintain that, Lex. Don't try to get too fancy in the ring. Don't listen to you say you're not a great worker. You have to look that they can't buy. Matsuda just pounded that into me. He said, always be confident in the ring. Keep your repertoire limited. You don't have to do all that flips and stuff that other guys do because they don't look like you. He really embedded that in me in a good way. And I think that, which ties into the other part of the question, could I have been booked better being more heel, all heel, or more Hall of Fame face? Whichever I was, maybe better suited for. But really, they utilized that to my advantage. I could be either a confident good guy or always walk the line of being an arrogant bad guy. And really, the way they really utilized me was like, I thought was great, which was a valuable piece in the companies I was with, kind of as a, talking about how I viewed myself like that, an all-star utility guy. I could be heel or babyface, and a lot of guys couldn't pull that off. I never totally lost my credibility. Not a lot of guys could have done that, so I looked at that as being a bad blessing. Usually I got switched. People didn't know behind the scenes when somebody on the babyface side or heel side who was irreplaceable got injured. They switched Lex Luger to pick up the slack on the heel or babyface side, and a lot of the pokers told me, Lex, we always knew we could switch you, and somehow the fans always bought into it because of your character. And they said, that makes you such a valuable asset to our company. It may not make you the star or the world champion, but in the big picture, we really value that. So I took pride in that as well. So I didn't look like I was getting shortchanged. I was much too confident in myself to feel that way.
That's a great way to look at it. And yeah, you did have that ability. And, you know, probably the best example that would come to mind of that, I guess, would be the winter in 1990, just a couple of months after you were getting the build as the number one heel in the promotion there. They flip you when Sting gets hurt, and you were a very, very convincing face there those couple of months, and you had a great run in that role. And, you know, your attitude also, too, it probably indicates that, you know, you mentioned in the book about being great friends and, you know, learning a love of coffee from Bret the Hitman Hart and being partners with him on the road. For as much as you guys essentially were rivals for that 93-94 top, you know, good guy spot there, you know, that attitude you're talking about probably shows why you were able to get along with an intense guy like Bret, because, you know, Bret obviously wasn't able to get along as well with Shawn Michaels because they were jockeying for that top spot. But your positive ability, you know, or your mental state there, it sounds like that allowed you to be friends with a guy even while you were both, you know, in position to be the number one guy in the promotion.
Oh, yeah, Bret and I got along. Bret didn't hang with a lot of guys. He was kind of deemed a loner on the road, mm-hmm. and Bret and I used to travel together, go to the gym. I joke about how he got me hooked on Starbucks coffee. He is, to this day, I mean, Bret and I always got along great. And I never had any issues with Bret or whether he was champion. I thought Bret was great with the belt. And I had no issues whether he got the belt instead of me. I was just really, to be honest with you, so cocky back then, it didn't matter to me. I mean, so I know it sounds weird, but I was like, hey, if they go with him, I think I'd be a great champion. If they're going with Bret, hey, great, he's a great champion. That was my attitude, really.
Well, and you were right about that. He's a tremendous wrestler, you know, one of the true greats as well. And, yes, you know, that's to your credit that you were able to see that and appreciate it, even as you were in the mix with him there. But that there's another thing that this is something of an urban legend that I'm going to ask about, because you've been fairly open about some of the things that came up in the book. There's something of an urban legend out there as far as you sort of inadvertently getting burned by something a couple of years ago, and that would be, of course, Sting's religious awakening predated yours by a couple of years, and there was something that I had read, and it's been unsubstantiated. You didn't address it in the book, so I'm guessing it didn't happen, but that apparently when Sting first came clean to his wife about some road stories and everything like that, there were some things, I guess, from Sting's wife to yours at the time that got back to you and kind of burned you at the time. Did that happen, of where you inadvertently got thrown under the bus, or was there nothing to that?
No, actually, his wife did not throw me under the bus. He did share stuff with her, but she did not throw me under the bus with my wife.
Oh, okay. That was, I figured it would have come up in the book for
I
as much as you were addressing.
I was mad at him that he shared that with his wife, but I didn't get thrown under the bus with my wife. My skullduggery and lack of good judgment behind the scenes on the road with women did not get back to my wife from his wife, Sue.
Okay. That was
so
that's,
I was mad
that's
at him
more
about
or less
the possibility. I was mad at him for a lot of reasons, which I share in the book. He was my best friend and comrade and chaos, recklessness, and disarray. When all of a sudden he wasn't doing that anymore and didn't want to go to places I go, I was selfishly mad. I thought I'd lost my best friend. I didn't understand. I was basically a self-proclaimed atheist, and I couldn't. I was like, man, he's gone. I thought I lost my best friend to religion. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. I was devastated. I was mad.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned the word atheism there, and what it comes back to in my mind a lot of times, and I'm going to ask this because you're someone who came from a family that valued education so much. There's a lot of times when educated people will fall into that trap of thinking that it's just a bunch of hokum and it's for less educated people. Did you, being a very educated person, have anything to do with that worldview, or was it incidental to it?
Oh, yeah, I had a totally worldly view, and I believe in Darwinism and evolution and science, and yeah, I did not believe in God. I thought we lived, we died, and we were worm food, I used to say. What is with those people? I never had or tried to look at an eternal perspective on things. I thought we lived, we died, and that was it.
Very interesting. Okay. Well, that having had that now of where it's come over you, I mean, I would guess that this would be the case a little bit, but I'm curious to know, has your awakening and awareness that you've had, has that elicited some of the same reactions in other people? In other words, it's sort of the pre-awakened Lex Luger mentality. Have you tended to get that from anybody in your orbit that just hasn't really understood the changes?
Yeah, but I've got such great mentors now in my life, and that they really teach me to not be judgmental or Bible thumper, so to speak. And they said, let your walk in the light and let that shine, and you'll use words if necessary. So I just try to be, by example, live my life the best way, God willing, I can now. And I don't try to, you know what I mean? I just try to have a good relationship with people. And I find that people that are teaching me, that's the best way. So I haven't really had a lot of, I would try to not be confrontational with people just because they don't agree with what I believe, because I was the same way. So why would I be confrontational with them? You know, I'm just going to love them and understand where they're at, because I was there at one time.
Absolutely, absolutely. You walk in those shoes, and you understand
absolutely what
that perspective's like. But it's one of these things where, do you find that a lot of times people just don't have a way to sort of connect it in a practical kind of way to their lives? Because to me, I almost really kind of prefer the word awareness to faith, because to me, it's a way where if you understand that there's something bigger going on, if you understand that there's a framework, then these things all really kind of make sense. And it's maybe a trap to try to make sense out of everything specifically, but to know that there's a reason and a purpose for everything that's happening, do you get the sense that people, when they hear the word faith, they just equate it with blind faith, and they don't really see a way that it connects to their life?
Oh, yeah. I was definitely there. And so, yeah, I agree with that assessment, for sure. We can't – God is God, and we're not. We're never going to be able to explain everything I tell people, you know? And when I finally got the position that God is God and I'm not, that was a huge step forward for me, that my puny brain and versus the Creator, I look back at myself back then, I'm like, oh my gosh, what was I thinking? But hey, I understand. And that I had a train of thought, and how can they believe in something they can't see and touch? And yeah, blind faith to me was, how could they do that? So I understand where they're coming from, absolutely. And their reservations.
Well, in terms of the changes that have come over you and your ability to get through things, obviously the mental strength that it gives you, obviously it would be something that would be readily apparent. But as far as like a before and after from when these things happen to you, afterwards, as I mentioned in the intro, you bravely battling to get through the paralysis that had plagued you for a period of time there. And the before would be the unfortunate situation when Elizabeth Hewlett, Miss Elizabeth, perished at your place, and the trauma that you went through because of the loss of her, and sort of getting dragged through the mud with all the publicity and the legal mumbo-jumbo. So sort of comparing and contrasting very bad things that you were a part of before and after, how has the addition of God into your life really affected your perspective?
Well, it's number one, he's forgiven me, which was tough for me to forgive myself for a lot of those things that happened in the past, but it's allowed me to forgive myself to move forward in my life. And also has given me God's perspective. I did what I did. It's that one of my mentors told me, Lex, you can't unring the bell once it's been rung. So I have regrets and things that I did that there's, you know, what shall profit a man? The book tells us, to gain the whole world, but to lose our soul. That's the road I was on. There's a universal principle of life. Now I can see that we reap what we sow, and I wasn't sowing good seed in my private life. Wrestling was always wonderful. I loved it. It was like a 15-year magic carpet ride. Behind the scenes, I was hanging with the wrong crowd, making the wrong decisions, not just people in wrestling. And it was eventually overwhelmed and devastated my life and those around me. It's not just you. People go, oh, man, what I do with my body and what I do is my business. No, it affects everybody around you. It affected me, my family, my friends, everybody. And looking back at that now, I understand that I try to speak to young people, use my life, the tragedies and things that happen as an example to them. If you don't build the right foundation in your life and have accountability and try to make good decisions, here's what can happen.
Well, those are great thoughts there and how you apply them to your life. I mean, there's a very famous saying from your business about living the gimmick. When I was reading your book, I don't know that I've ever been aware of anything more living the gimmick than when you talk about going past, like, store windows, you know, and admiring your reflection in there. Everything. Like, well, that's something I would expect to see in a vignette on TV, but you were actually really doing that. So you were living the narcissist gimmick, even if you couldn't see it at the time. I just thought that was kind of funny.
Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding me? I was 24/7. I get up and gaze at myself in the mirror in the morning and flex and pose and oh my gosh, I was 24/7 living the total package back then. It was ridiculous. Yeah, I was very fond of myself.
That's awesome. I'm sorry. That's just a hilarious story. And the fact that you can tell it now, and that, again, you've learned to put the perspective, you know, and what that mindset was, is just, you know, very, very admirable. The fact that you'll tell that stuff and did in this book, such an excellent book, Wrestling with the Devil, The True Story of a World Champion Professional Wrestler, His Reign, Ruin, and Redemption. Very nice alliteration in the title there. I like that a lot. As far as, you've got the book promotion going on now. I know that you're doing some stuff with the WWE Wellness Program, obviously volunteering with the church. What are some of the other things you've got going on right now?
I'm into health and wellness, and I travel around and help encourage people on living a happy, healthy lifestyle through nutrition and exercise. I have always loved that. I like to work with a lot of the young athletes and let them know that, hey, it's just not wrong to do PEDs, and it's wrong if you get busted, you're going to get penalized heavily. But at the same time, I try to give them a healthy alternative that gets great results with scientific advancement now. If you really work hard on your training and eat right, that you can get incredible results now with the advancements we've made scientifically and nutrition. So I like to go around and help the young guys with that as well and just try to give back. And then at the same time on weekends, if I get the door opens to give some, share my faith with people and share what God's done in my life when I know that he can do in their life. So I'm just living the dream. I call them the man of leisure, living the dream.
That is awesome. You're out there, and that's great that you're using such a positive focus for your life and spreading it to other people. Again, you're somebody who really had an excellent career, but I don't often say this on the show, but I would say you are a great man, Lex Luger, for everything that you were doing to spread the word of God and positivity to everybody. And it's been a true pleasure getting to talk to you in the course of your book tour here. And when things settle down from that somewhat, and you don't have to make as many appearances on the other programs out there, love to have you back sometime and continue to talk God and your career and everything else with you, sir.
Thank you. A great interview. I've really enjoyed it, and I'd love to come back. Thank you, my friend.
Thank
you. Have a great evening.
Thank you, Lex. I truly appreciate it. For our 300th mini episode, this was a true pleasure to get to have you on and talk these things with you. A little bit of living the dream on my part. I truly appreciate it. God bless and all the best to you. And thank you all for tuning in, everybody. Mini episode number 300 of the FDH Lounge.